Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Betsy Fordyce, and I argue on behalf of the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center as guardian ad litem for the child, SD. In the dependency system, permanency and stability for children are of the utmost importance. With this in mind, decisions to set aside a default judgment must be made carefully in light of all of the surrounding circumstances. Here, the trial court failed to make the proper inquiries pursuant to Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure 60B when it set aside the adjudicatory and the termination orders as to John Doe, thereby allowing RY to reassume the role of parent after 15 months. This error was twofold. First, the court failed to conduct a proper hearing that would allow evidence to be presented and argument to be made. And secondly, because no hearing occurred, the court failed to require father to meet his burden of proof in setting aside the judgment as well.
Well, Ms. Fordyce, what kind of notice was given to RY?
Your Honor, RY received notice in multiple capacities. First, in the dependency system, the concept of John Doe seeks to provide notice to unnamed fathers and preserve their due process rights while simultaneously recognizing the need to move forward in these cases.
But isn't there an argument to be made here that RY didn't know that he was a father?
Your Honor, in this case, I believe that RY did have service by publication and also the general delivery service to John Doe. But that aside, he had constructive notice of these proceedings.
And didn't the wife here, or the mother here, excuse me, didn't she make active representations that the father was someone else?
Your Honor, the Colorado Supreme Court in the case of First National Bank versus Fleischer says that in setting aside a judgment as void, notice is to be considered in light of all of the surrounding circumstances. Here, those are some of the circumstances, but certainly not all of them. And had the court conducted the proper legal framework in making its decisions and setting aside those judgments, that may have been proper. However, that didn't occur in this case.
So let me, if I could interrupt, sorry.
Sure.
Did the court make any findings regarding the notice question?
No, Your Honor. In deciding to set aside the adjudicatory and the termination orders, the court essentially disregarded the guardian ad litem's objections to paternity and standing and ruled without any factual findings or legal analysis that RY's parental rights were intact in the case.
And so you wouldn't object if it were remanded for a hearing?
Your Honor, I think if the case... Certainly, this court has the ability to make a ruling on the facts now before it. I think that what is in evidence is possible. However,
but there's a John Doe out there somewhere.
I'm sorry.
I mean, how does the notice? How could we decide notice?
Part of considering the circumstances surrounding notice in this case are not just the legal notice to John Doe in this case, but also the constructive notice that this father, RY, had in the proceedings. He had notice not only of the child's existence, but of the proceedings as a whole. As the court is aware from the record, the letter that he wrote to the department suggested that he was the one that called in the initial referral. And to allow a father to have knowledge of proceedings and of a child and stand by while a court enters orders as to a child.
But when does this letter occur in the chronology of events?
It occurred at the time that the dispositional order was entered by the
court.
Right.
I mean, he at the time, notice is supposed to be effected.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing in this record to indicate that RY knew that he had an interest.
Your Honor, I think that the letter in the record does suggest that RY had knowledge from the very beginning of the proceedings. However, that information was not all before the court, given that the court didn't conduct a hearing under the proper legal framework.
Well, the court did have the letter before it, right?
The court had the letter at the time of the dispositional hearing. It did not at the time that it allowed RY to enter admission as adjudication. Now, the cases that are cited by the petitioner in their brief and will likely be argued here today, In re CLS, In re JMA, and Armstrong v. Monzo, are both clearly distinguishable from the facts now before the court, but also entirely consistent with the legal approach that we are promoting here today. In the case of CLS, the court affirmed the setting aside of a judgment as void in a private adoption case. In that case, mother told the court that she had been raped and was unaware of the father's identity. She told the father, likewise, that the child had died. So the father in that case was unaware of the child's very existence, let alone the proceedings. Similarly, in the case of JMA, another private adoption case, the court ultimately remanded to the trial court with instructions to make a determination as to a due process violation, as to whether the notice in that case was sufficient or not. And finally, in the case of Armstrong v. Monzo, the United States Supreme Court did find there to be a due process violation when no notice was given in that adoption case. Now, the difference here is that those three cases are private adoption cases, and most of the time those consist of one hearing in their entirety. This was not a case where RY didn't have notice of one hearing. RY had knowledge of the child and of the proceedings for 15 months and failed to at any point intervene into the case.
Let me ask you a hypothetical, and I realize the record is not what it might be, but if mother knew that RY was the father, and fraudulently and purposely did not disclose that information to, you know, the authorities, under those circumstances, would that make a difference?
I, at the end of the day, there would still need to be a judicial determination as to those issues. I think Rule 60B2 requires that. In this case, I don't believe that the department, though, committed any fraud on father when it sought service by publication. And while mother, it would have been certainly preferable for all of the parties had our mother identified RY at that first hearing, the fact that she didn't do so doesn't in any way take away from father's actual knowledge of the proceedings.
So mother's fraudulent behavior or her acting knowingly or with reason to know is irrelevant. What you look to under your positing, you look to what the department did, its diligence, and what it knew or should have known.
In this case, yes. The parties below had argued that judgments be set aside under 60B2 for purposes of fraud, I think that those factual that factual evidence may have been relevant to a finding, but here, in order to set aside the judgments as void for lack of notice, I think that the circumstances surrounding RY's notice are what matters.
So there could be a due process violation if RY, if the mother intentionally withheld information about the whole case until we get to the disposition.
It would need to be a case-by-case determination by the trial court, I believe, as to whether the party seeking relief from whatever judgment has been entered has met the burden by clear and convincing evidence that the judgment be set aside. But if the facts in that case supported that ruling, I think that would be a different case. At the end of the day, what we're asking is that there be a proper legal framework. Certainly, there may be cases in the dependency context where default judgments should be set aside. But the point is that should not be done lightly. It should be done in light of the proper legal framework, with the proper burdens being applied, so that the child's permanency isn't sort of unnecessarily toppled in light of parties maybe knowing in actions.
Well, the termination of a parent's rights shouldn't be done lightly either.
No, Your Honor, certainly should not be. However, in this case, when a father has knowledge of the proceedings and of the child and stands by and fails to act, a parent's own knowing inaction is not a due process violation in and of itself.
And you think the record shows that?
I do, Your Honor. I believe that the evidence...
Because of the letter that was filed after the notice was given.
The only evidence that is in the record at this point, Your Honor, is the letter that was entered as part of the dispositional hearing, and then also at father's first appearance, I believe it was at the August hearing, he made a statement to the court that he had in fact called in the initial referral to the department. I think that suggests that he had knowledge, and that was at the time that the guardian ad litem made the initial objection to standing
attorney. When he called in the initial referral, he had knowledge of what? The abuse of the child, or the fact that, no question about it, he was the father of the child?
Your Honor, the letter that is in the record suggests that he had knowledge of both. He had an intimate relationship with mother at the time of conception. He was living with mother and the child. He engaged in caretaking of the child. He stated that he believed the child looked like himself and like his children. And not only that, he did have knowledge of the proceedings. He knew that mother had a treatment plan and that the child was no longer in her home. It was his position that if, or his belief, that if mother didn't have the child return home by November of 2011, that there was nothing he could do. And yet, knowing that belief, or being under that belief, he still failed to take action until May of 2012.
Well, but when you're saying a letter suggests this or that, all goes to the sufficiency of the notice, that's all sounds like questions of fact to me. It all sounds like consistent with CLS and JMA that a court has to find whether notice was sufficient.
Your Honor, if the court had conducted the proper legal inquiries and allowed evidence to be presented last August when the issue first came before the court, I think that, those determinations could have been made, but that's not what occurred in this current case.
Father's counsel did not file a 60B motion. We're not here on something like that where we're challenging the termination itself post facto or after the fact, right?
Your Honor, I think that because the initial adjudicatory and termination orders entered by default, the proper rule to set them aside would be Rule 60B under any of the provisions that are listed there, specifically with regard to this case, though, with regard to 60B3.
Ms. Fordyce, is it possible that if the case were to be remanded, the trial court could take the position that he treated the father's letter as a 60B motion?
It is possible, Your Honor. However, at the time that that letter was admitted, Father had already been allowed to make an admission under the petition, and the child had already been adjudicated as to RY. That itself was improper. Even if the court would find that that RY didn't have knowledge of the termination proceeding, there was nothing invalid about the initial service by publication that led to adjudication.
I understand that, but my point is that I suppose at this juncture, the trial court could treat this as a 60B and determine whether or not there was a good and sufficient reason to set aside the default.
And if Your Honors are not inclined to rule on the record before it, we would ask that it be remanded with instructions so that the court could make the proper inquiries pursuant to 60B and apply the proper burdens of proof under that legal framework. Unfortunately, none of those things happened in this case, and now this child has been lingering in the system when the Children's Code emphasizes permanency. Setting aside judgments outside of the legal framework in the dependency context, as the court did in the current case, strikes uncertainty into every default judgment in the dependency system and raises every child's permanency into question. And when those decisions are made without the proper legal inquiries, the court can't know whether the circumstances surrounding notice were sufficient. There needs to be greater findings, there needs to be greater attention, and setting aside judgments as void or by fraud without those proper inquiries is not consistent with well-established law and default judgments, nor the Children's Code's emphasis on permanency. I'd ask to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right, Ms. Fordyce.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Laura Grosetta Gibson, Assistant City Attorney in Denver, and I'm here on behalf of the Department of Human Services. I am sharing my time with Respondent Father's Counsel, so we'll keep time and go forward. Registration number 14599. The guardian ad litem is seeking reversal of the court's order adjudicating adjudicating the minor child dependent and neglected as to this father, the biological father, and the dispositional hearing. In addition, the GAL is also arguing that the court's decision to set aside what it considered a valid adjudication or judgment of adjudication and termination as to John Doe also included father's parental rights, and that was clearly erroneous because there was no hearing held. The difficulties with this case are manifold. There was the initial assessment of the case and mother's initial determination, or at least indication to the department as well as the court, that DH was the father of the child and did not mention RY as the father or even a possible father. The department did what it could do to locate DH and was unable to do so and proceeded to termination. Actually, the guardian ad litem filed the motion to terminate, but termination was sought subsequently as to mother because she did not follow through with her treatment plan, and as to the named fathers, or at least the fathers known to the department at that time. When biological father RY came forward in May of 2012, he indicated in his letter that he had tried to get hold of people and was frustrated, and finally was able to, through subterfuge, I guess, with mother, figure out how to get hold of the department and come forward. It's clear from the letter that he did not know that he was the father of the child, certainly not definitively. Mother had told him on countless occasions that he was not the biological father, and even though he had suspicions that he might be, there was no knowledge that he was in fact the father. When he did come forward, the department believed that as it often will do, and always will do, I guess I should say, unless there's a no appropriate treatment plan scenario, will do what it can to reunify a child with a parent and rehabilitate the parent as needed. In this situation, when father came forward, it determined that it would be appropriate to have genetic testing done so that we could have a determination as to whether or not he was the father. The case procedurally is a very convoluted one, to put it mildly. When he came forward, the department asked that genetic testing be done. There was no Rule 60B motion at that time. Nonetheless, the court did allow the genetic testing to go forward, and when the court decided not to have a hearing and not to have briefing on the issue of father standing to participate in the dependency and neglect action, the guardian ad litem filed a motion for reconsideration. In the motion for reconsideration, the guardian ad litem references Rule 60B. So I think at that point, the court allowed for a hearing to take place. The court said, okay, we will have a hearing. That was set, it was continued again. In the meantime, father asked the Supreme Court for a Rule 21 ruling, and then that the Supreme Court remanded to this court, which remanded to the juvenile court to allow a hearing to be held.
Ms. Ebsen, would you characterize that hearing as a 60B hearing?
I think for the most part, yes. The court looked at father's notice of the hearing, looked at mother's actions, and was able to make determinations with regard to the evidence. But that doesn't appear to be part of the record at this time, and that's problematic as well. It looks as though father, in his petition on appeal, asked that the evidentiary hearing transcript be a part of the record on appeal. Father's counsel also filed a motion to supplement the record several months ago to include that hearing, but I'm not sure. It doesn't appear that that hearing actually was transmitted to this court for its review. But the juvenile court did have a hearing and did make findings, but this court, I think, is somewhat hamstrung in light of the fact that we have the appeal that came forward while that request was still pending and before the hearing was held.
Well, if there was such a hearing and it's not here, does that mean we're supposed to presume that everything that happened in the hearing would have sustained the judgment?
No, I don't think so. I think one of the options is to remand the case, but that causes its own difficulties with regard to achieving permanency for the minor child. But at the same time, it is appropriate for there to be a hearing, or I think this court has the other option of dismissing the appeal outright, in part assuming, given that the guardian ad litem indicated that the appeal was taken from the adjudicatory order, the dispositional hearing order, that seems to be untimely filed, at least from the department's perspective, given when the dispositional hearing was held, when the initial written order was signed and served on the other parties. So there is that option, and that would allow the court to proceed with achieving permanency for the child.
You've read the transcript, I assume?
Yes.
And I'll ask other counsel. I mean, if we were to receive the transcript, would that obviate the need for a remand?
I think it would, certainly on the issue of whether the juvenile court's actions were clearly erroneous, in light of its having a hearing and assessing the information before it. It did make a determination, and so I guess one option...
I'm sorry to interrupt. What did the court find? Did the court address the notice question?
The court addressed the notice question. The court also addressed the issue of mother's keeping father's identity from the department and from the court, and found that the father while obviously he had made the referral, so he knew of the proceedings, but he certainly did not have noticed that termination was at issue, and that he did not have notice of the termination hearing itself, and that mother's actions really constituted a fraud on the court. So I think the court, the juvenile court, did make appropriate findings and did make the proper determination that father had standing to participate and have an adjudication and dispositional hearing. And at this time, I would like to turn the podium over to father's counsel. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Clark Aguilar, attorney, registration number 24387. The guardian ad litem would have the court believe that R.Y. had some mechanism to interject himself into the proceedings. And eventually, R.Y., through his persistence, was able to interject himself into the proceedings, but initially, he wasn't even given notice of these proceedings. I think that we basically have several problems here, and I think that's been brought out by the department. Number one is our argument, respondent father's argument, that the appeal is not timely. What has happened here is this court is being asked to choose between two orders, an order of November and an order of December. The order of November 19th was signed and distributed to the parties. However, that was not a satisfactory order to the guardian ad litem, because 8 days later, the guardian ad litem goes in and submits a different proposed adjudicatory order, which the court then signs on December 4th, and then the guardian ad litem chooses that order to do the notice of appeal. Our position is that the first order is the order that should have been appealed. If that's the case, then the matter was not perfect. The appeal is not timely. We would also agree, father would also agree, that the service by publication was not proper as to R.Y. Certainly, mother knew who, or should have known, that R.Y. was the father. She continued to not identify the father. In fact, when the caseworker does an unannounced visit to mother's home, shortly before they remove the child from mother, caseworker notices an individual there as R.Y. Mother just indicates to the caseworker, this is a new Genesis client, completely denying that there was ever a relationship and there was ever a possibility between, or that R.Y. would be the father.
Did R.Y. speak up at that time?
No. In his letter, R.Y. indicates that his arrangement to live with mother or stay with mother was that he could not identify who he was and what he was doing there. He was homeless. He paid mother some money to stay there. And part of that was he would stay in a room whenever unannounced visits or anybody came by, and he would not say who he was. And it was only on that unannounced visit that the caseworker ran into him, and mother then says, this is just a new Genesis client, doesn't identify him as a possible father, or that they had lived together, or that they had an intimate relationship. In the curious part about this particular notice is that roughly 3.5 months after the termination hearing, in March of 2012, the guardian ad litem notifies the court that notice to John Doe and others may not have been proper. The court doesn't rule on that, but the court has that piece of information that the guardian ad litem itself or herself knew that there was a problem with the notice. Several months later, the court then has genetic testing indicating that R.Y. is the biological father. The court then acts to protect the due process of R.Y. by vacating or setting aside the termination order of December 2011, because it at least had two pieces of information. One, that the guardian ad litem had refiled a new motion for termination indicating there was a problem with that notice to John Doe and all others. We would imply that that notice was also faulty to RY, in part because Mother just did not disclose him. And then, overall...
Is there any way that the department would have known that Mother wasn't disclosing him? I mean, were they on notice that she knew something that they didn't know? Or?
No.
So how can you blame the department for not putting him in the notice?
I'm not blaming the department. What I'm indicating is by Mother not providing that information, there was no way the department could obtain it. It was Mother's actions. It was Mother's actions by failing to disclose who Father was, failing to, even when confronted by the caseworker, asked, who is this individual in your house? While Mother was on a treatment plan, she basically hid his identity.
So the court did this on its own? Yes. Vacated the termination?
I'm sorry?
Vacated the termination order as to Father?
Yes.
Without a hearing?
That's correct. But the court did have those two pieces of information. One, that the guardian ad litem had doubts about the proper notice, and that the genetic test had confirmed that RY was the father.
Now, the transcript that is not before us, does that address notice? Does that address these factors?
I think in part it does.
Could you explain?
The court, after its hearing, had made the determination that its actions were proper. It indicated that Father's parental rights were intact.
And as I understood Ms. Epson's argument, also made some finding about the mother having visited a fraud upon a court.
And Your Honor, that certainly is upon the father's position also, is that we believe that Mother did commit some type of fraud.
No. Did the court address that at that hearing?
Your Honor, I believe the department is correct in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aguilar. Ms. Fordyce, you have 2 minutes and 12 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just three brief points in reply. First, with regard to the argument that the appeal was not timely filed, certainly the guardian ad litem did file in a second dispositional order. But that was merely because the initial order filed by the petitioners was stock in nature and did not contain the actual specifics of the proceedings. Now, certainly the court is presumed to know what's in its file and what orders it signed, and that court saw fit to sign the second order. The appeal was then filed within the proper timeframes of 3.4 from the date of the entry of that order, and I think that the appeal then is timely before the court. With regard to the facts before the court now on appeal, we are appealing the adjudicatory order as to RY through entry of the dispositional decree. And the hearing that occurred after those events took place did not serve as the basis for those orders to be entered.
Was the hearing before the dispositional order?
It was not, Your Honor. It did not occur until February of 2012. Okay. So those orders were entered without any of the factual basis before it. And with regard to that, to the subsequent hearing, the court has asked questions with regard to that record. While evidence was presented, I don't think it was clear, pursuant to Rule 60B, that the court made its findings and orders that RY met the burden by clear and convincing evidence, which is what's required to set aside a default judgment. So while evidence did come before the court, there is still ambiguity as to the proper legal framework for setting aside these orders. And in order to ensure that children's permanency is kept in mind and at the forefront of these proceedings, it's imperative for the courts below to have guidance in terms of what a hearing should look like in this regard. So for that purpose, we would ask today that the court reverse the adjudicatory and dispositional orders as to RY and reinstate the adjudicatory and termination orders as to John Doe and all others.
Well, Ms. Fordyce, this although this hearing occurred after the dispositional order, as again I heard Ms. Epson argue, it was of the style of a 60B hearing. Would you characterize it that way as well?
Your Honor, I see my time has expired, if I may respond to the court.
Certainly.
I would
my time
state
isn't.
That we have all afternoon. I would suggest to the court that while evidence was put forward that would allow the court to make findings as to 60B, that wasn't the proper burden of the proper burden of proof wasn't applied in those cases, and there wasn't reference to 60B specifically in the sense of setting aside those orders.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much for your argument, Ms. Fordyce, and thank you, counsel, both for your good arguments this afternoon. This matter will be submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.